Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 538. At Midnight is a big week this week. Our 100th episode already. I can't freaking believe it. 100 episodes of At Midnight. Tonight we have Jason Nash, Busy Phillips, Andy Daly. And then tomorrow, the 24th of June, Doug Benson, Nikki Glaser, Ron Funches. Three people who have won the show a bunch of times competing for our 100th episode. Then later in the week, we have Steve Byrne, Owen Benjamin, Roy Wood Jr., Harley Mornstein, Grace Helbig, Hannah Hart. It's going to be a really, really, really fantastic week. And then also, I'll be appearing at VidCon next weekend. I'll be doing panels and presentations, and I'll be all over there. So I'll see you at VidCon next weekend if you are going to be in Southern California for that. And I'd like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Stamps.com will keep you from the madness that is the post office. Now, I don't have anything inherently against the post office. It's not their fault that it's not a great experience. It's just, you know, everyone needs to mail stuff, so they all descend at once. People get cranky. It's busy. There's parking issues. And so you don't have to deal with any of that with Stamps.com. You turn your PC or Mac into your own personal post office. You buy and print official U.S. postage using your computer and your printer, and then you don't have to go to the post office. Your mail carrier will just pick it up from you. We have this continuing offer. If you go to stamps.com, it's a $110 bonus offer. No risk trial, digital scale, up to $55 of free postage when you use the promo code Nerdist. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. This episode is my old pal, Greg Barrett. And Greg's a very special person to me. He was maybe the first or second person I called, when I got sober, because he had as well. And he's gone through a bunch of shit, and he's a great guy and one of my favorite comics. And so this was a really interesting delve into, because we hadn't really caught up in a while. So I pulled a lot of good lessons out of this chat with Greg. And, you know, when shit happens, the best thing that you can do is just take stock, you know, get a little perspective and say, how can I live better? How can I do better? How can I be better in the world? And so that's definitely what he's done, and definitely what I always try to do whenever shitty things happen. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast number 538. Greg Barrett will be in the he's from the Walking the Room podcast, of course, with Dave Anthony, and he'll be appearing at the Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival July 25th through 28th alongside Todd Barry, W. Kamau Bell, Matt Bronger, Kyle Kinane, Morgan Murphy, John Roderick, and more. Info and tickets are at boatparty.biz. Nerdist Podcast 538, Greg Barrett.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I'm okay. How are you? What's going on?
I'm okay. This doesn't sound good at all.
I'm fine.
It sounds fucking shit. I'm okay.
No. I'm a little wet, Dad. I have to go to New York tonight.
I'm going to Chicago.
You going to Chicago tonight?
Yep.
What are you doing?
The Schaumburg Improv.
Schaumburg.
Schaumburg's right. You know, Schaumburg is the right outside.
Is that near Shermer?
It's the one where they go, man, you're doing the Chicago Improv. And then you're like, no, that's like saying San Jose, San Francisco.
Yeah.
Chicago, it's not even close.
No.
Get the fuck out there.
It's not even right outside.
And
that was wrong.
500 seater. So,
it's huge. It's in a mall.
So when I bring in my 150, mm-hmm. I feel really fucking small.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a joke there. I was doing this Comedy Central show, and I said, oh, when they told me I was going to be doing the Chicago Improv, I thought we were going to be in Chicago, but we're not. We're in Schaumburg. That's like telling someone they get to go to one of the coolest cities in the world, and then they have to go to Schaumburg.
I like it. It's
they didn't.
So true.
They did
it's
not
so
like
true.
That.
Is that Chicago Shelbyville?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a white suburb. It'd be like going to Marin. It'd be like saying you're in San Francisco playing Mike Marin.
Well, Deanna, who's from the Chicago burbs, she says the thing about most of the Chicago suburbs is that it's like they're like suburban white people, but they have a chip on their shoulder because they say they're from Chicago. So they're like we're not suburban people. We're from Chicago,
right?
But
right.
They never make it to the city.
No, and people from the city are always like, dude, I'm going to come to your show, and then like an hour before, like, you know what, man? I get it. The traffic. It's. I mean, that's also just my fan base. In general, the theme of my
you know what man
my tours are always this There'll be tickets. How are the tickets? Well, they're not. Well, there'll be tickets. Oh, Baron will be. It'll be easy.
Oh man, I think the last time I did stand up with you was like 2009 at the Comedy Works in Denver.
Yes.
Those were really fun shows.
Yes. That's when it was. At that point, I made a pretty nice paycheck and I left it in the hotel. Remember, we stayed in that really cool hotel with all the candy in it?
Oh, I didn't stay in that hotel. They had me in the condo, which actually, the Comedy Works downtown condo is not bad. I mean, it's like.
No. And the other one's pretty nice. The suburb one is nice.
The suburb
too.
One's nice too, but you were staying in that like kitschy hotel right around the corner, which was had the cool restaurant in it and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, Comedy Works is, there's a handful of really magical clubs in the country, and Comedy Works is just one of those places.
Comedy Works is it's because the people go because it's the Comedy Works. So like if you're a young comic who's headlining for the first time, you'll still get a crowd because they're pretty sure it'll be decent.
Yeah.
You know?
That was when because you headlined for the weekend, but I came in like a day early and I headlined on the off night. And then and then I opened for you the rest of the time. It was really fun. And then during the day, we kind of tooled around Denver and went to vintage record shops.
Right. Is that when we went to the punk rock shop that I made the joke about? The thing where I said there was a big anarchy A on the outside right next to it, the hours of operation?
Yeah.
Just like, no rules. 9 to 5. Yeah. 9 to 3 on Sundays.
Like, just, we are going to vacuum up oppression.
Yeah. It was like super tidy. Like it was all the shirts were lined up. It was super neat. It was like nicer than a Gap.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I think that's part of the tidy rebellion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I always like a very, someone guy with like an anarchy tattoo or an anarchy shirt or something like that, or a patch, but it's, the A is like very meticulously inside the circle. I always think it's like, it shouldn't be inside. The A should be busting out of that circle, like the anarchy sign. You shouldn't even care so much to even write it down.
My favorite conversation that I've ever heard was John Taylor. From Duran Duran was on when Steve Jones had his, his show.
Jonesy's Jukebox?
Yeah. And Jonesy goes, so the A in the circle, what is that all about? And John Taylor goes, really? He goes, yeah, what's it about? He goes, it's anarchy. And he goes, what's anarchy? And they sound alike in my in my version of it. And he goes, Steve, it's like, no rules. So there'd be no rules at all. No, there'd be none rules. I thought it always should have been B for biscuits. Like, no, it
says the guy from the Sex Pistols.
From the Sex Pistols, yeah. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think
that would have been a different song. I want biscuits. Biscuits in the UK. I like cookies in the USA.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No. I'd hop on that more now than I would.
Yeah, I think biscuits are. Yeah. Well, you can get a lot of people to agree on it.
Jonesy is so great.
Yeah, he's rad. He's good.
We did a full, we shot this thing for our YouTube channel of 3 episodes of Jonesy doing this thing called Game of Jones, where he sings the season plots from Game of Thrones.
Oh, wow.
And someone from our team was just like, before we put this up, I'm going to send this over to someone at HBO. They'll think it's really funny. And the HBO people were like, oh, yeah, you can't put this up. Because we were gonna use clips from the show.
Oh, no.
And like, you just do it. You don't ask. You just do it. They won't say no if you give them the
permission.
Yeah,
by the time they know it's over.
Because many people, like bad lip reading, like all these people use clips from Game of Thrones, and they don't squash it. They would have been fine. It's just they gave them the option. And so, when we did WonderCon this year, I showed season 3 Game of Jones, and it's fucking great, and he's really awesome. Funny. And now we because they said no, now we can't put it up.
That's a bummer.
Oh, man. Bad lip reading is fucking,
that's where we need
bad
anarchy.
Lip reading is amazing.
Anarchy.
Yeah.
Biscuits are the new anarchy. Bad lip reading is amazing. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
100%.
The NFL ones just fucking kill me, and I could give a crap about, I don't care about football really, but I just, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the Game of Thrones one, I think, is that it's the storyline is that one of the guys, and it might be Ned Stark, maybe it's Ned Stark, one of them wants to open a Renaissance-themed park. And so there's like, and then we'll put these over here. Like, it's really... I went to the Ren Fair this year. It was fun.
I love going to the Ren Fair. It's a lot of fun.
You know what I learned on Hollywood Game Night the other night? That there's a Ren Fair Barbie.
What?
Oh, is there really?
There's a Ren Fair. Like, they're like, which one of these is not a Barbie? Or which one of these is a Barbie? And they listed them all, and every one of them was, they were absurd, and every one of them was actually a Barbie, including Ren Fair Barbie.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's,
was there
it's dirty.
Person that was
it's
like, Black Barbie.
Black Barbie, yeah. But the Ren Fair one has dirty feet.
Bam a lamb. Oh, Black Barbie. Bam a lamb. Black Barbie had a child. Bam a lamb. Lamb and go blind.
I mean, you're like two songs away from an album, Chris.
Yeah, I've got Biscuits in the UK.
Biscuits in the UK.
And Black Barbie.
Black Barbie. Bam a lamb.
Bam a lamb. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Yeah, I'm doing all right.
I want like you mentioned it, the Mohawk on Jonah Radio, and I want you to reiterate. I was just telling Chris about it. I think it's a brilliant move.
I like the Mohawk.
Well,
by the way.
I appreciate that. It's strategical though. Like it's, I mean, I like it, and I would wear it. But
it's a strategy hawk.
Well, this is all gray, and then I'm going bald back there. Like I'm, you know, it's wearing through.
Mm-hmm.
So I just cut it all off. I just cut the parts I don't like. I don't like the gray. I don't like the hole at the back. So this is what's left.
Yeah.
This tidy little, like, almost sailor hat mohawk.
You know what, though?
It's a pompahawk. Is what
but
I call
that's
it. It's
like
a pomp. It's like a pompadour and a mohawk.
It's in. But that look is kind of in.
Right?
Yeah.
It's, I mean.
But it wouldn't matter if it was in or not. That's anarchy.
That's, yes.
That's
anarchy.
That's Biscuits. You know what you've got in your head now?
Dude,
you've got Biscuits
in
the UK.
I'll biscuit the shit out of it. No, I don't care.
Have you ever seen a guy with a mohawk that's going bald? It's like he has the spikes and then there's just one missing.
There's just a gap.
Yes.
Right. So I had it grow down the back and then there's just this noticeable in photographs. You go, well, it just sort of stops for a little bit and then picks back up. And I was like, just stop it there.
So if you're 20 and you have a mohawk, that's anarchy. But when you're in your 40s and you do it for strategy reasons, that's Biscuits.
And if
biscuits.
You are a month, less than a month away from your 51st birthday, you're just tragic.
How do you
absolutely
how do you feel
tragic.
About that?
Like
do you
is
feel
a
okay?
Panic. It is a panic attack. It's like, oh, somebody's having a crisis. Do I feel good about it? Yeah. I like my 50s way better than my 40s. I hated my 40s, so I really,
really?
Liked. Yeah, I mean, I had a good, like up to about 44, things were pretty good, and then it just kind of went in the shitter for a while, and now I'm enjoying my
50s. Can we have a conversation about that?
Yeah, totally.
I hadn't talked to you for a while, and it's, you know, it's a travesty that we're in year four of the podcast, and you're just coming on now, which I accept responsibility for, but I was talking to Dave.
Yeah,
at your partner on
Dave
on
Anthony.
Walking, yes.
Yeah,
and we were because he wrote on Talking Dead.
Yeah,
In as much as you can be a writer on that show, he's you know coming up with the in memoriams and stuff.
Yeah, and now he's now he writes Marin.
Now he writes on Marin.
Yeah,
and Dave Anthony is fucking hilarious.
Yes,
yeah.
He is a phenomenal comedy.
And the reason you haven't heard of him is he's one of the angriest people that's ever drawn breath. He's gotten much better in recent years, and not unlike Mark Maron, but there's a reason you don't know who he is.
I feel like there's a story that might have come from you where someone was heckling Dave at the improv, and the guy was a larger gentleman, and the guy stood up to kind of get in Dave's face, and Dave goes, "Sit down, Butterpants."
He said, "Sit down, Butterpants." He's really good with the heckle, like because he's already mad and expecting a fight, probably just from growing up with his dad, that like... A woman yelled at him when we were at the Comedy Works, and he goes, "Bring it. I grew up with an alcoholic father, and I am so prepared for you. Just knock that shit. You think you can take me down? Do it. I've been hit."
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
It was weird. It got super dark.
Yeah.
Like, his comebacks were like, whoa, dude. Like, just shoveling. But he's, you know, he's funny, man.
He's real funny.
He's a funny dude.
He brings a knife gun to a gunfight.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
But I talked to him at the season finale last year. I said, "How's everything going? You know, how's Greg?" And he was like, "Oh, you didn't hear?" And I go, "No, what?" He goes, "Yeah, man, he got addicted to dog Vicodin." And I was like, "He got addicted to what?"
Yes. Yeah.
I go, "Are you doing a bit right now?" And he goes, "No, he got..." Because, you know...
Not unlike my haircut. When I do something, I do it my way. I do it the way I'm going to do it.
So, but just going back, I think it's important for people to know that you've been sober for a long time, longer than me. And when we first met... It was you were at that fateful Largo show that I bombed horribly at in like 1996.
It was
an Aspen comedy
audition
showcase.
Yes, And I went up, I think I went up right after you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then, I went up right after you. I did well. And Tompkins did really well. And Tompkins was the only one that got asked that year. But, so I was mad. But, I watched you. I've known you since you were booking the show at UCLA.
Yeah, that's right. When were in the early, back then.
And then you and I both auditioned for Trashed.
MTV's Trashed. Yeah,
that was sort of your...
We just keep going back further and further and further.
Yeah. Long history.
The first time I ever saw you was at Luna Park.
Right.
Which was the best... was Uncabaret. It was... Yes. I don't know if it was called Uncabaret at that time. It might have been, but it was a comedy show, maybe like a Monday or Tuesday night comedy show at Luna Park in West Hollywood.
Sunday nights.
And so, of course, the off night, they would give it to the comedy. And so it was in this little back room, and I was at UCLA, and I was in this stand-up comedy club where, you know, me and Mike Furman and Steve Callahan, who's the EP of Family Guy now, and Pat Megan, who writes on Family Guy. But it was good.
That's crazy.
It was a good group. The class before us was like Shane Black, Sully McCullough, Chris Spencer, like all these different, you know, it was actually a really, Ed Solomon, you know, like that was the class before us.
That's crazy.
So, but then I discovered what would come to be known, not it wasn't at the time, as alternative comedy.
Yes.
And immediately fell in love with it. And so I would go to those shows at Luna Park every Sunday with you and Blaine Kapach and Janine.
Odenkirk,
Cross, Posehn.
Yeah.
Patton was kind of trickling in a little bit.
Right. Jack Black would be there every once in a while. Kathy Griffin.
Margaret Cho. And it was amazing. So imagine like every, you know, quote Tompkins. Unquote alternative comic Paul Tompkins that you respect now as open micers, basically. Yeah. Which is ultimately what it was. It was the, this is our club, this is our room, you know.
Right. And Beth had sort of a it would be great. Like, people didn't like it then, but now people do these kind of shows all the time. But it was like you couldn't have material; you had to somehow mine your experiences from the past couple weeks or month.
You keep going.
Yeah. So that was just it. That was sort of the thing. And some people were like, "Well," like Doug Benson was like, "Well, that's not what I do." And then they wouldn't get asked to do the show. And then, but it really was like Beth just had this thing that, for a few of us, Janine, myself, Dave, it was really like right in our ballpark. Like I learned how to become a comedian there because I had jokes, bad ones, before Uncabaret. And then I got sober during Uncabaret, and then they had me on every week because they were fascinated with my breakup with Garofalo and all this other stuff. And then that's how I ended up writing a one-man show and starting my comedy career. But so that was the beginning of that particular...
Holy shit, that was such an amazing time.
Particular
and so,
thing.
So we started a show at UCLA that... I don't know. Someone started a show at UCLA that it was on campus and it was all the same people. So it was just like on a Tuesday night or something in the Cooperage, which was our kind of like food court area that had a stage. And because I watched you guys do this different style of comedy, which I hadn't yet figured out how to categorize, having just come off of the 80s comedy boom, where everything was very much this, joke, and then watching this very free-form, we're just trying to find ideas, and it's loose, and people have notebooks. I saw
jokes, and before it was jokes and characters, so you were either telling jokes or you were emo or Bobcat.
Right.
Like you were an absurd thing that
you just needed
get
a hook.
Their head around.
You just needed
dice.
A quick hook.
Yeah, you had to have a nickname because when Posehn started, he called himself the Piranha.
That's right.
So he had a nickname, like he was in that era, and I was this close to calling myself Skull Candy the Impaler. So for no reason. But yeah.
So I saw you guys, like I would see Janine with a notebook and I would go, oh, so having a notebook. You know, having a notebook on stage is a fucking habit that to this day I still do it. Because I developed it back then. And even though I don't use the notebook, I just like having it there. And so when I did that set at Largo in 96, I was in the midst of Singled Out. And so it was because of that I was able to get on some shows. And Largo was just starting to become like the hot, you know, like alternative comedy had evolved a few years.
Yeah.
And everyone was getting real good. And it had this audience and this following. And Largo was this hotbed of amazing comic energy, and the audiences were great. And so, you know, I had wanted to do stand-up in college. I did a little bit in college, and then afterwards I didn't do it, but I was doing Single Out, and so I ran into Josh DiDonato, who was running that room, who went to UCLA. Yep. That's where I knew him from. And he said, hey, man, you should come by and do the show. And I was like, sure, I did. You know, I want to do stand-up. That's the ultimate thing. But yeah. I've just been afraid to start it. But this is a great place to start. But, you know, it would essentially be like dropping a kindergartner in a calculus exam. But the kindergartner thinks, I know math.
Yeah.
And so I got on stage. I had my notebook. I purposely had undeveloped ideas because I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Right.
And even if I had developed ideas, I don't think they would have been good because I was young and really just sucked the air out of the room, completely sucked the air out of the room.
Well, you know what? Lisa Langing had this sort of bizarre – she was a girl who booked it after Josh. I still talk to her. She had this bizarre way of putting new people right up front, like in the worst possible position for them following the host, who could sometimes be great. Or sometimes do like what Brody Stevens does, which is like absurd and you're laughing, but you're not really ready for someone to come up and just do anything stand-up-y. And so you were in a tough position. And I think certainly there was a room full of people like, whatever, singled out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because if David Cross and I were like talking one day and we're like, we were so judgmental of anything that came before us that if you had a fucking callback, you were a hack.
Wow.
Like if you rolled your eyes, it would be like, oh, please. Like you couldn't walk around with the microphone. You couldn't have a guitar. Like you couldn't do anything because it was sort of like this. It was like cleaning out all of that, all of those things that seem like a trick.
Yeah.
Like even though having a notebook and not knowing what you're doing is also a trick.
Well, it's nonconformist conformity.
It's like the whole
thing. It's biscuits.
Like, it's biscuits.
It's Pearl Jam.
Biscuit
like,
comedy.
We just wear what we wear. I know, but you're all wearing leggings and short pants and Docs. So you don't. You have a real uniform on. You're almost the Beatles. Like everyone looks exactly the same. So it was just this kind of slight rebellion. And also it was around the same time as grunge. So it came with this like earnestness and everybody wanted to be. I think it was good because the women in that scene succeeded quickly and faster than the men. So like there was a Mr. Show, but like Silverman and Janine and Kathy Griffin
and Cho.
Those people got, the girls were the ones that got big quickly. Keitlinger, like they were the ones that actually blossomed out of that scene. I don't think people ever really remember that. And then later on, Zach and, you know, whatever, other people would come out of it, you know.
What an incredible time.
Yeah, it was a good time.
And it was so we kind of knew, we sort of knew each other then, and I was a huge fan of your stand-up, and I feel like a lot of my stand, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but I see traces of Greg Barron influence in my stand-up to this day, which is like really, really fast. You know, you were one of the first people that I was like, oh, you can just go up and go ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da and just like hammer people really fast with a bunch of fast.
If you move quickly enough, they're not aware that there aren't any jokes.
Like, I'm in your lesser kudu. Good night. You know, like the lesser kudu joke.
There was a lot of like working up to one big undercut.
What was that joke where you saw the lesser kudu and you're like, and there I am, and we're having this experience, I don't know when the experience is over.
Like, it was like the thing where you go, I don't know. I went there and didn't understand, like I didn't like it, I didn't care, I wasn't moved by it, and I didn't know how long the experience was supposed to laugh or when the right time to leave the cage was. And so I'm like, this is just, it's, I go, because it doesn't have an ending. There's no clear point where you're done. Like if it went, I've been a lesser kudu, thank you, good night, and you go, well, fuck, I walked away, I'm not going back again. So I would wait for other people to leave, and that was that bit. And so, then I think it ended with me being in a museum, not understanding a painting and punching a woman in the head, because I think it was one of those. And so then I hit her punchlines, which are pretty great. And then I'd ring a bell. Ding, ding, ding.
So Trashed, you would audition for Trashed.
Yeah.
And then I ended up getting Trashed, but then we sort of, you know, our scenes sort of circled each other for a while, but I didn't know. Your sobriety goes all the way back to Uncab days?
So 96. So like right in the middle of
96.
My last drinking night was at Uncab, and then I stopped at the Formosa on the way to meet Tompkins at Bird's.
Jesus.
So I was like, and I threw up on the bar at Bird's and then took some money out of Paul's wallet and bought myself. Like, I really was like, it was just like bad. Then I went back to where I was living with David Cross and played guitar and woke him up at like 5 a.m. And then I woke up and was like, this is not, you know. And it was the thing, I think part of the thing that was
I think there were a zillion. There's always like a zillion motivating factors happening at once. You know, there was a girl that said, please don't ever call me when you're drunk, that I called when I was drunk, who was like, you're a fucking asshole. And there was the fact that like Cross and I couldn't have been from more different backgrounds. Like he grew up fucking dirt poor with no dad and in the South and Jewish. And I grew up white with money. So here's this guy who's had everything and is a fucking failure. And here's this guy who's got his own TV show. That's the, like, it's what he's wanted his entire life, that he's been focused on, that it was Cross Comedy when it was in Boston. And he came out here and he worked on the Ben Stiller Show. And now he's got Mr. Show and he fucking worked for it. And he would stay home at night and write sketches and not go out and drink. And I was like, I got to get my shit together, man. So Cross, being around Cross, oddly enough, you know, was a part of the reason I'm like, I got to figure out what do I take out of the equation that makes it so I can at least do stand up. Mm-hmm. Well, so that was it. So I was like, I'm done. And I was also pretty sick, you know.
Well, when I quit in 2003, you were the first person that I talked to.
Yes.
Right after I quit drinking, I think it was like the next day, I think I called you and I said, I think I can't do this anymore, but I don't know if I can. What was the process like? Is it hard? I don't know if I can do this. And you totally just sort of walked me through it and took the time. And, you know, so in addition to sort of like being a stand-up role model, you were also a life role model of like, oh my God, this guy, you know, this guy that I respect, he did it.
Right.
He's supportive of me. Oh, why can't I do it? And so I did. And that was that. I mean, I'm making it sound like, and then everything was fine. I mean, ultimately it all worked out. It was difficult, but I appreciate your support.
It's a roadblock. You know, for a lot of people, it's a roadblock, and you take that roadblock open and the fucking road opens and suddenly you can do shit. Suddenly you have the wherewithal. Like, I need to be firing on all cylinders to be mediocre. I have to have it all together to do like fucking indecent work. Like, I need to, like, I can't have anything distract me. Otherwise I will not, you know what I mean? So for me, it was just like, I can't get anything done. And I'm, you know, and I'm,
but isn't it funny though, that we take this idea that what if I need this to be funny, or what if I need this to succeed, or what if I need, and then when, and maybe you didn't feel that way, but then when I quit,
no, cause it's like courage. It's like, you know, there's something about, you know, everybody. You have one drink and suddenly you've got a bunch of ideas, you know, and you're like, oh, fuck, this opened up a new world. It's a world you already possess. You just have to allow yourself to access it.
It's just that people who have overactive brains, like overactive internal monologues, anxiety, right, and whatnot, what they don't realize is that something like alcohol or drugs, it kind of knocks that voice out of the way for a few minutes.
Right.
Because people don't realize you can learn to do that yourself without, you know, the distortion that comes along with substances, you know,
right.
I mean, using it that way.
Right. And then, you know, if you jump to the dog pills thing, what the other thing was, is that I struggle with, you know, some form of mental illness. Like, I struggle with some sort of like anxiety and depression,
sure,
things that didn't go. Because my life was so much better after the booze, I was like, oh, okay, I'm fine. But not unlike alcoholism, mental illness is progressive. It just gets worse and worse and worse. And I had a very bizarre career trajectory that no other comics ever had, which is that you got famous for writing a book about relationships for fun. You know, I wrote He's Just Not That Into You one summer after Sex and the City was gone, and I had said the thing in the show, and I was like, maybe we'll just make a, somebody else was like, let's
fucking
make a book out of it.
Boom, Oprah.
And it just rocketed, and I got everything you would want to have if you wanted to be a self-help author and not a comedian. And when it was all over, I was lost, like really lost, and really like, and now it gives me an opportunity, because I know there's people from my podcast that are listening to this go, are you going to tell Chris that you called him out on your podcast? I'm like, yes, I'm going to tell him. Because I was really upset with everybody. I would write these long letters to like an insane person. I would write these long letters to my manager. I don't understand how you were like, just like accusing him. And I don't know if you've met my manager, is David Martin. He may be the nicest person that's ever been in show business. He's not an asshole. Mm-hmm. He's just a lovely Australian. And
I know him.
And I was like, Hardwick never even has me on his fucking pod. What happened? He used to fucking do shows with me. Like, I really lost my mind.
By the way, now to that extent, maybe was a little kooky, but But you're not wrong. Like, you should have been on this podcast
a long
time ago.
How hard would it have been for me to go, hey, man, we haven't seen each other in a long time. I know you're super busy. I feel a little bit like I wish you would ask me to be on your podcast.
Oh, you would.
How hard would it be to, like...
And I would have immediately said, oh, my God, of course. You know, the problem is when you build these... When you kind of build these kingdoms in your head of what other people are doing, and you feel like they're excluding me, they're moving on, they're not, they don't want me. Most of the time, they're really just thinking about themselves.
No,
100%. And so, you know, it sucks, and of course I'm really sorry. And
no, I get it now. I didn't get it then. You know, I've had conversations with. Have I had conversations with Janine Garofalo, who feels like, fuck, how come, where are my buddies from back in the day? You know, everybody has that thing. And it's not that people aren't thinking about you. It's just that they're like, I'm doing this other thing. And I haven't even been aware that you would be something that would be a part of this. Or a lot of people are like, he's a zillionaire. He's fine. Like, people just assume you've got a thing going on because they're not watching your career and checking in with you to see if you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You don't know till you hear later on. But I had like a... So what happened was I got like on the verge of, I mean, if I'm being super candid, like I got very, very almost suicidally depressed one Christmas. And I was fighting with Amira and it was just a bad time. And my dogs, who were 18 each, had hydrocodone, which I didn't know what it was until somebody had walked by during a dinner party and went, Jesus, what is that? That's for your dogs? You know? And I was like, oh yeah, I didn't think about it. So about a month or two later, I was like really depressed and it was Christmas Eve and I was like, fuck this. And I took one and it just, everything felt much, much better. Like it just smoothed everything out. And then, so, you know,
That is amazing. I would never think to do that. I'd be like, well, that's a dog pill. I mean, I know it's hydrocodone.
That'll make me throw up.
Well, I was just like, well, then here's my thing. I'm like, well, this is for dogs. So it's not, the rationalization was like, well, this isn't real drugs.
It's like children's aspirin.
But it is exactly real drugs. In fact, it's at three times the potency because dogs' metabolisms work fast.
Fuck.
So it was really like a really hardcore opiate. And I didn't know. And I wasn't really even sure what it was. I just know that when I took them, I felt better. And then I couldn't get off them, which is the classic. You take one, you don't take another one for a month. And then it just built up to 2 years where I was like, I've made some – in this time period, I've really made some mistakes. And the up and downs are bad.
And you must be looking back and, you know, when you're when it was at its worst, how many were you taking?
Five.
Five a day?
Yeah. Well, I'd take five and then that would...
How were you getting them?
On that. Well, the dogs would get them, you know, like they would get them mailed. And then one of the dogs died because they were 18. So then there was just a jar of them and they would literally like it was like a shaker full of them. There was just a ton of them.
Jeez.
So your dogs weren't like going to an alley downtown?
No. Sure. That would be awesome. That would be awesome. Yeah, with Anthony Kiedis' dog, we would meet him. We'd meet under the bridge. There we go. There's another song. The record's coming together perfect.
You have to do all the different ones, like jingle dogs.
But yeah, so it...
Sorry. You started that. I was just yes and
no
musically.
I like it. I believe in it.
So that's amazing. So you must at some point have looked back and that's, you know, the problem with addiction and the problem with this kind of thing is that it is so progressive and it's incrementally progressive, but much in the same way that interest accrues over time and all of a sudden starts becoming a very substantial amount.
Right.
That type of thing, you can look back after a while and go, how did I get here? Like,
well,
when did that happen?
The thing that I understood about it the entire time was I never drank again. I wasn't partying. I wasn't like, yeah, let's get out of our minds. I was like, I don't want to kill myself. And this will keep me from killing myself, except for when I start to come off of it, when then I feel like killing myself and taking others with me. And I can't stop the voices, so then I'll take more of them. So it was like this really insidious, it's just what drug addiction is. And I couldn't admit to anybody that I was still going to meetings and stuff.
So how are you justifying that?
They were dog pills.
That's so interesting.
And also, well, I assume this is what doctors give. Like, I'm medicating myself to keep myself from, I'm doing it, I've prescribed myself my own medication to keep myself mentally
ill. You were able to put it in a cubicle that made it acceptable. Like,
yeah. But once you start telling those lies, everything's off the table. So you just start, you know, you just become like drug addicts do. You just lie about all kinds of shit.
What would you have done, like, with the tools that you have now, what would you have done differently when you got into that moment where you felt like...
Gone to a therapist.
Were you not seeing a therapist at the time?
Uh-uh. Oh. And I didn't call my sponsor or anything like that because I'd sort of distanced myself from the program. So I was just sort of like...
It's so hard.
I felt dirty.
It's so hard when you're in the depths of it, though, to have the presence of mind to... You know, you almost have to be kind of lucky in a way that you have one moment of clarity or someone comes along and says, you are a pile of mess right now. Yep. You need to go, because I would imagine when you're in the depths of that, you can't see out of that hole
right.
to go, I should go see a therapist. This what seems like the simplest idea probably wasn't the, even.
No, and it really took like some very private, horrible things to, you know, land me into rehab and then also like. And then I was just, you do, you look back, you go, how did I not, because that was it. Then I went and saw a therapist, and then I got on, you know, prescription meds, which I've been on for a year and a half now. And that I describe as like it was like I was in an elevator that was falling. And as soon as I got on the medication, I take an anti-anxiety in the evening and a antidepressant in the morning, very small doses, and the elevator just stopped. And then all the problems fell. Like, for instance, I would go, okay, what am I mad at Chris about, really? Like, the guy's having a career. So fucking call him. Or don't act like he's such a fucking baby. And your manager has been nothing but good to you. What about your wife and kids, dude? Like, wake the fuck up. And so it was a really good, like, but then I could deal with it. Because I was like, okay, I fucked up. What do I got to do to fix it? Whereas when I was falling, I was, you were wrong. You fucked up. And my wife fucked up. And they were like, it's just that weird thing of like, the problem was on every, the show business was like, everybody left me behind. It was like, whoa, dude.
Did you ever accept responsibility for anything?
No, not until I got sober. No, really. Like, I would go on these tirades about being beaten down by, he's just not that book fucking ruined my life. Like, I would say, and I'm like, I'm saying this from the home that I live in that was purchased with the money and the schools that my daughters go to that was really ruined your life. Like, yeah. It was,
well,
just
I think what it probably did was rip your identity in half, and it made you, because you were this, you were a comedian, you were a fantastic comedian on this one trajectory, and this other thing pulled you aside. You know, you go on Oprah, you have this advice book, and then all of a sudden they're going, hey, do you want this kind of show? And I'm sure in your mind you're going, well, it wouldn't be my first choice, but you know what, I think I could probably make it work. Why not? This is an opportunity. Got to do it. I can be funny. I can be me. I can make this work.
Yeah. Right.
You know, as we've all done with...
But you make the point perfectly right there, which is, and I think I heard... Justin Theroux, the guy that wrote Iron Man and X occasionally, whatever. And
yeah, goes he's out with, in yeah. the follow or the Left Behind or Leftovers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a talented yeah. guy. But he said the second you start selling something back to yourself, it's not for you. The second you say, I might be able, if I do it this way, you know what I mean? As opposed to the thing you really want that you know you can do. The thing that you know, well, it'll take work, but this is what I want, as opposed to like, I'll take a daytime relationship show and make it into the daytime relationship show version of the Daily Show. Like, that math doesn't work, and you're not taking into consideration the world or what's really being asked of you. And if I had it to do over again, I would have said – because I said no for a really long time, and then I realized I wasn't going to get anything else. Like, Comedy Central wasn't interested in doing – no of the other networks wanted to do anything with me.
I mean –
they all wanted – or they wanted me to write a relationship show or something like that.
I mean,
so,
look, it – you know, we've all had those points in our – I mean, I did so many pilots that I'm lucky did not get picked up because of right. the types of shows they were. And I know that sounds shitty to people who are looking for work and like, how the fuck could you be happy about that? Because I don't care how much money you make or how many times a day your show is on the air. If you don't like it and it doesn't fulfill you creatively
– right.
At a certain point, the weight of that will crush you. And again, I know that sounds shitty and spoiled to people if you haven't experienced it, but at the end of the day, you really have to like what you're doing. You have to like what you're doing.
Yeah,
and you have to like yourself in it.
Yeah, and you have to like yourself for doing it, but you also have to realize like that is not who you are. Nobody, that's not you. None of it's you. It's like I am me when I'm at with my kids at their dance school. That's my actual life. That's when people actually see me. That's when I'm in the real world being me, or at dinner with my wife, or out with my buddies. You know, that's that's what's real. This other shit is just stuff that we're all sort of focused on because we're here, and it doesn't mean anything. It just, I don't care if the people on Twitter don't like me anymore. Like, I you know, you start to get invested in this, like, what the world thinks of you and what you're putting out there. And it's like, it just doesn't fucking mean anything.
Yeah.
Especially, I think I've learned so much now from Twitter. Like, oh, it just doesn't fucking mean, there's just mean people there that are going to say shitty things. And then they're like, and then there's just, you just do your thing. You just fucking do your thing, you know? And you don't care, because what matters is, like, when I'm off work and I have enough money that I can take my kids on vacation, or I can go do something fun. You know what I mean? Or like, I just did this 8-week tour in Australia, and it was a thing called the Melbourne International Comedy Festival Roadshow. So it wasn't beholden on me to sell tickets. There are four acts on the show and a host. There was a tour manager and a stage manager, and we went from town to town to town. And every night it was full theaters. We talked about this the night, and I was like, this is what I want. This is it. This is the tops. I'm fucking working every night. I'm doing stand-up. Everyone likes it. It's not my responsibility to be great. I don't need to be bigger than this. This is exactly what I want to do. I just want to do my act. I just want to be funny and make friends. And having had a quick moment of like fame, it's like, oh, it's so fucking hard to figure out where you're supposed to stay or what you're supposed to do or what matters. And none of it matters. Nobody cares. Because one day I'll get sick and something will go wrong, and I won't need Twitter followers. Right?
Yeah.
I won't need Twitter followers. I've made some cool friends on there. Don't get me wrong. Twitter has been great. And the people that listen to my podcast, and you know what podcast fans are. They're some of the coolest, some of the greatest people ever, because they need this, and they come to you and they're like, thank you for your podcast. And that feels good. But like why am I not on Chris's show is not a thing. That's not real. That's not a real thing. That's a stupid thing to be. And also, if you want to be on Chris's show, just ask him. You know what I mean? Like, you're creating a thing that's based on how much you think Chris thinks you're popular, or if the world thinks you're popular, or if you're done or not. And it's horseshit, right? You get to control how that is anyway by just like going, hey, I'd like to be on that show or whatever. I wrote you and said, hey, if you do the Meltdown shows again, I'd like to do it.
Yeah.
Because I thought, well, they don't see me. I barely ever do your show. Why would they think of me? So if I write him and say, I'd like to do your show, maybe he'll say yes. But if I go, fucking Jonah, man. Him and Kumail have fucking lost it. They used to be cool. I only like Kyle Clark.
Yeah. Who?
Oh. He's right behind you, Jonah. He's been right behind you the whole time. I don't just mean here.
So, yeah, but you know what I mean? Like, and look, you have built a really beautiful thing. And I think I was trying to explain to my friends in Australia about your show, because I was like, it's never been. You like found the right perfect thing. At Midnight is like the perfect thing that, like, they've been trying to do shows that somehow encapsulate or use the internet for years. Like, we're going to run a scroll of what people are tweeting. Nobody gives a shit. Like, it's going to be interactive, and nobody gives a shit. But your thing is perfect. It is what those things have been trying to be for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's great. There's no other thing like it. It's your original own deal. And like, it's something you can go, I did, you know, I was at Midnight. Like,
one of the things that makes me happiest about the show is that, especially, you know, when comics do it for the first time, you know, a lot of times they're nervous or they don't know how, and then they do it afterwards and they're like, it happens all the time. So I know I'm not making this up or I'm not seeing something that's not there. They genuinely say to me, like, I can't believe how much fun this was. This was so much fun. Mm-hmm. And I want to come back. Like, even if they don't win, they're like, I want to come back and do this, because the spirit of it's just, I don't know. It just sort of, it activates the thing that we like to do.
Well, it's fun. There's no real stakes. It's ridiculous. But every one of us is confronted with a computer every single day. So the fact that like someone's managed to sort of find the nuances of the things that are funny about what's going on in the world and the hashtags and stuff, because we do, you know, when a news story breaks, I go to Twitter to see if it's really happened. When somebody dies, like, you just go to see who's posting what. You know, I can't just go to CNN or any of those things, because they might not know. I had a famous friend die. And I was in Scotland, and I found out an hour after he died, because I heard from a friend. And I was like, I wonder how long it's going to take. And so I just sat there all night and I watched Twitter. And sure enough, someone's like, I'm in New York, and I think there's an ambulance outside of, like, it just started happening.
Oh, wow.
Hours before it was actually made, like, maybe even 24 hours before it was mentioned. I saw an ambulance outside of so-and-so's place. I'm pretty sure, I don't know what it is, people speculating about it, you know, and then piecing it together. And it was a news story before it was actually a news story. And so the Twitter makes sense because you're like, well, there, somebody close to somebody's going to tweet.
Yeah.
Right? If a thing goes off, people are going to go, this just happened, and then it'll pass around. You know, sometimes they're true. Sometimes it's the guy from, what it was, I got duped on something yesterday. Who'd they say died? Oh, the guy from The Walking Dead.
Who did they say, was it Norman or was it?
Yeah, they said he, it said found dead in a hotel room. And then you click the link and it goes, gotcha.
Good
2000
joke.
And so a lot of people to click this link. Well, of course they would click this link. Yeah. You didn't get me.
Yeah.
Yes, you got my humanity.
That's like, boy, the,
sure,
that's
you
like,
sure got me. You scared me about a guy I don't even know.
That,
he's dead.
That's the Simpsons thing where they're doing like the morning radio shows doing crazy calls.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, here we go. He's picking up. Hello? Is this Mr. Johnson? Yes. Well, sir, your wife has been found. Yeah. She was in a terrible car accident. Oh my God, no. I was just with her. And you hear him going, and then he turns the radio away. Yeah. But it's that kind of, it's not hard to fuck people up in that way.
Yeah.
So you had this sort of weird identity crisis. And so what did you come away with?
So I came away with basically what I was just saying is like, I'm all of the things, just like you're all of the things that I am. Like if somebody asks me for relationship help, then I'm a relationship expert. That's it in that moment. And then I play in the Reigning Monarchs. And then when I do stand up, I'm a stand up. But I'm just Greg Barrett or the King Sweater, which is now what I've changed my name to because I've got a very strange ego. But I don't wrestle with it. I just don't care. It doesn't matter. I'm True and Mighty's dad, and I'm Amira's husband. And those. If I just do those things, everything else takes care of itself. It just sort of falls into place. So if I keep that as like my North Star, I don't give a shit. I don't care what. If somebody wants me to work on a relationship show, I'll do that. I don't care. I just need to make money and work and be of service and help people who need what help. And if somebody wants me to go play in their band or do whatever, or go to Australia for 8 weeks, I'll do that. Because none of it really matters anymore. You know, it doesn't – I don't need and I've been around long enough that people kind of get it or they don't.
Yeah.
You know? But I've also become really solidified in my opinions, too. Like, I used to sort of – there was a period where I would push the book away because I wanted dudes to like me. And then I realized a couple months ago – or not a couple months ago, but when I was in Australia and that hashtag all yes, all women,
mm-hmm.
I started to go, man, I don't like men at all. Like, I was like, women can't have a fucking hashtag? And I was like, you know what? I have always stood over here, and I'm not going to fucking back off it. Fuck you, dudes. Get your shit together. Leave women alone. Let them have their own fucking hashtag. It's a hashtag.
You know, yeah. I remember when you told me right after the book kind of popped, and you said you went to do a show, and you go, you know, I'm up there, and I'm, you know, the show's not going as well, and so I start digging into all the old, like, A-list stuff, digging back, and it's just, you go, no one's responding, and I'm sweating like I have not sweated since I was an open micer. And then you finally just went, what is it? What do you want? And someone just raised their hand, and they go, I have a question about the book. And you're like, you want to talk about the book? And everyone's like, kind of. And oh, so you turn all the lights on, and the show just became basically a Q&A.
That's exactly right. It was the first. Crazy. It was the very first set that I did after Oprah, and it was at the Improv, and I went with Dave. And we drove home, and I was like, it's over. My career's over. What am I going to do? And then in that 24-hour period, I realized, just fucking mention it. At the beginning, just talk about Oprah. Just give them a little taste.
Yeah.
And so I wrote this bit about being on the show, and then I went back, into Chain Wallet and all the other horse shit, and then they were like, yeah, fine, no problem. Just don't pretend I'm not here. Yeah. You know, I'm a room full of women, and we came out to hear about this thing, because that's how we know you, dude.
Tom Wilson does that. He says when he does a road gig, he's like, I'll bring up that I'm Biff, and I'll make some jokes about it. I'll answer some questions, but after that, comedy show time.
Yeah.
Time to like just now you're going to hear my jokes about my kids and stuff.
And I'm certain you're held to certain things. There are things people want to hear from you. You can't help it. I mean, that was the thing that was so obviously in a bigger sense. That's the thing that happened to Chappelle, where he's being held to these notions and ideas of who he is or what he's about or what's appropriate to say to him. And I think he goes to a place like Irvine, and it's all white people, which has happened when I opened for him years ago. And somebody shouts out the N-word, and he doesn't know what the hell's happening. And then the guy's being dragged out of the show going, no, because he says it. Because he says it. No, I'm not mad. No, he says it. And they're like,
Jesus.
But you don't get it. So it's that thing of like sometimes you baffle your audience, or your audience is not aware of the joke. You know, and that happens with a lot of people. You know, I did some shows with Attell. Now, because when, so one of the things I did when I was trying to make a, try and figure my career out was I asked if I could just go open for people, because I didn't want to perform for the people that came to see me because they weren't really stand-up people. So I was like, could I open for Patton and could I open for Attell? And so I would go do some shows with those guys where nobody even knew who I was. With Attell's crowd, nobody had any idea who I was. Zero idea. And,
that feel great.
It was nice. And then on the very last night with Attell, I mentioned the book, and the guy goes, "I knew it." But it was already halfway into my act, so they were fine. But it was, but you know, even Attell's crowd are like, those aren't people he wants to be responsible for. Those late show crowd people that come to see him that are insane and slamming Jaeger and knocking.
Well, you know what happens is we are.
I said Jaeger almost like Jaeger. A cross between. Jägermeister and Hagar.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm sure he's trying to develop that drink right now.
Oh, my God.
It Sammy Jaeger.
You drink and then you pull like a curly blonde lock out of your mouth.
Jaeger sounds like a planet consuming Decepticon.
The Jaeger.
I am the Jaeger is coming. Wop, 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 wop.
But I think... God damn it. No, I just sidetracked myself with a fucking Jaeger joke.
I like so Jaeger.
It's one of those classic Hardwick Jaeger jokes.
It just wasn't.
He does it all the time. Hashtag Jaeger, by the way, everybody, please.
But so first of all, what was Oprah like as an individual?
Well, here's what's cool. So in the post rehab, because I didn't go the first time. I just went to meetings. So in my post-rehab thing, like maybe a month in, Amir and I got invited back to teach a life class because we put out a book. We put out a book that we had written that we didn't release because I didn't want to. And we released it in America called It's Just a Fucking Date. And they asked us to teach a life class. So I had already been on Oprah three times. And every time I was on there, I only saw her on the set. And that was it. One time she came backstage and said, "That was an awesome show." Which they said she never did. So that was kind of cool, but I didn't really know her. But then when we went to do the life class, we met with her to rehearse. She came down in her pajamas with her hair undone, no makeup on. And she was one of the things I realized when I was there was like, she's no different than us. Show business. She was a TV host.
Yeah.
She was originally a TV host. Like she was not a goddess that like she wasn't a queen or she wasn't this person that built cities in Africa. Like she was just a person that wanted to be on television. So she's like that backstage. She's funny and she can be dirty and she's just in show business.
Yeah.
And she's a good host. Like one of the things that's really cool is like if you're mildly amusing, she gives it to you. Like, you know, like when you do a good morning radio show, when you go on and guys just laugh, like they just are like, "Man, thank you." at least they're like, "I'm psyched you're here. This is welcome. You can have my piece of territory. I'm not trying to own this." And she's the same way. She's like, "I'm Oprah, so you can have the floor. Take the floor." Like the third time I did the show, she was super sick. And she was like, "Just do it. Just run the show. Just I will ask you questions, but you got to run the show."
Isn't it interesting, though, because you do as a performer – and I think a lot of us don't really think about this because, you know, when you start out, you're like, "I just want to succeed because I want to get to this place where I can have these things that I think are going to fill the hole and make my life better." But I think it's an important question to say, well, who's my audience? Because your audience is basically, you know, like you mentioned Attell's late show crowd.
Right.
Well, if Attell gets famous because he's doing a show about going out and getting drunk and fucking around at 2 o'clock in the morning.
That's right.
Who's going to respond to that show? People who like to go out and get drunk. Who's going to come to that show? If you do a thing about relationship experts, who's going to come to those? You know, like you have to be aware of what you're putting into the world because that's
it's going
to
reflect.
That's what you're going to attract.
Yeah. Right. And that's 100% it. And when I quit stand up for a little while because I couldn't deal with it. And I would say when I talked about it, it's not your fault that you came here to hear relationship stuff. That's why I'm famous. That's why you're here. That's why you know me. There was a movie. There's a whole deal. And I don't have that for you because that was never my thrust. That was never the thing that I talked about. It was never, you know, I could talk about it. I'm good at it on a person-to-person level. I'm good at it on Oprah. But it's not a stand-up set. It's not stand-up. It's not stand-up comedy in any way. Or it's the most pedestrian, uninteresting stand up. I've seen Bill Burr has better relationship material. You know, Dave Anthony has some of the best relationship material I've ever heard. Like, it's just wrapped in Dave Anthony, but it's smart and it's really good. And I don't have that stuff. So it was one of those things where I refused to try to write it. That was my problem. Was I would tell a story about Oprah and then I would do nothing else. And, you know, I remember one time, this is a perfect example of what my career was. Irvine with Karen Kilgariff. Karen was in the bathroom during my set. There were three girls in this and they were like, I fucking hate this. This is stupid. He didn't say anything I wanted him to. And they were super drunk and super gross. And yet there's a guy that laughed so hard in the front row, he had a seizure and fell out of his chair. Oh, and they sent the paramedics in. And I was like, was he super drunk? They go, no, he's just laughing so hard he didn't get air to his head. He died.
See, that's where you need to...
So you're like...
Did he die?
No, he didn't die. Oh, good. They said he almost died. They were like, he was very close.
Okay, so then you need to put that on a poster.
Yeah.
Warning, you may die at this show.
You could possibly die.
You could use that as a marketing tool. The guy's fine. He'd be fine with it.
He's fine. But the thing was, it was that thing of like, I know how to do this thing really well, but I also know how to... you know what I mean? It's both things are happening at once.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think, you know, ultimately... Success or not, success isn't going to be the thing, or that, you know, the material success or that thing that people think of as like, oh, that's the thing to have. That part's fine, but the real thing is, and like when I decided to just start, you know, pursuing things that I actually cared about, I just felt like as long as I'm doing stuff that makes me happy, if I can survive, it doesn't really matter, you know, like but to get into this mode of like, I need these other things to try to, and it's not like I'm above it. I still, you know, we all still do this version of, oh, if I just had this.
Sure.
Then you get that thing. It's like, oh, now this thing and this thing.
I thought,
you
know, it was this thing. It's not.
It can be a fine roadmap, but ultimately you have to love what you're doing because you have to live with yourself and you know, and
that's right. And at the end of the day, you get no decision on how people receive you.
No,
you just don't get to decide.
You don't. And like, I think it's easy to look at, you know, like, I guess musicians are probably the best because it's pretty, I think it can be pretty black and white with them where, you know, or like with Kurt Cobain or Pearl Jam or bands like that, where all of a sudden they're super famous, but it's not necessarily what they thought it would be. And then so, you know, you hear these stories about they thought they were a fraud because they felt like this public facing side of them was not who they are. And everyone thinks they know who they are. And you as a regular person goes, well, who fucking cares? They can just get in their Rolls Royce and go back to their big home. It's like, yeah, but then they're sitting in a big empty house and they have this insane identity crisis, which is a real thing. Like, right. It's a real thing. I mean, obviously, you know, it would be helpful that, like, they have all the resources in the world to try to fix it, but most of them are too fucked up to do that.
Well, did you?
And that's why you need to have someone in your life that can go, you should just go over here for a bit.
Did you see the Dave Grohl's South by Southwest?
It was a great
keynote
speech,
right? No. And so he talked about the thing that killed Kurt Cobain was guilt. Guilt that he wasn't cool, that he had let down some idea of who he was supposed to be, and it's the dumbest thing in the world to be killed by. And you can't, like you said, you can't forecast who's going to like you or what you're going to do. So you might as well just do it because it also changes. Like, I don't know if we talked about this the other night, Jonah, but when I came out of that crew, what we talked about earlier, there are a lot of people that were like, Greg Barron is not, by the way, alternative. Like, there were actually articles and people said things like, he's not in that, he's not David Cross. Like, I had a guy come up to me and go, I know you think that you're like David Cross and those guys, but you're not. And I was like, they're my friends. Weird things like that, right? But then, so that was a period of time where people were like, I was like the Stone Temple Pilots of, right? That was what I was told. Like, I was a pretender or I wasn't the real deal or whatever like that. So that's a period of time and it was real and it happened. But then time moves on and there are kids that grew up watching me. And they just think it's, and they're like, and they're the younger people now, and they come to the shows, and they had a different experience also. So it changes. And what the thing that they can't take away from you is not quitting. You stay in something long enough, you become something way different than you thought you were going to be.
Well, that's it. It's just that time marches on, and what are you going to do with that? And if you allow yourself to listen to those people, and the truth of the matter is, you could take something, you could turn something into like a personal credo because someone said it to you, But in their mind, it was offhanded, and they didn't even think twice about it. So like that guy would go, "Oh, you're just a pretender," and you can see that guy a year later and go, "You know, you said that to me, and it really affected the course of my life." And that guy would be like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Like, he might not even remember.
Oh, man, I was super drunk. I don't remember
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you'd be like, "What?"
Well, which is a shitty thing to say.
You know, you have to be careful. You have to be careful not to take disposable comments, you know, which are pretty much all of social media, too much into your soul and core belief system, because it's, you know, however you feel in a moment, like it's sort of, you know, I liken it to like how I am in traffic. You know, if I'm alone in my car, I'm just saying things at people. They don't know that I'm saying things to them. But if someone, you know, like cut in front of me, I'd be like, "You're the worst person I've ever seen in my entire life." If I actually said that to that guy, it would have an effect on him. But in my mind, I'm just blowing off steam. I don't really think that.
No.
Yeah. But that guy could, if he heard that,
really
he could really take that to heart. And, yeah. And then later I'd be like, did I say that? I don't even fucking remember. What are you talking about?
That's right. People don't. Yeah, exactly. But the other thing is, you have a responsibility as somebody in the arts to be heartier than that. You don't engage. You don't fight back. You just ignore. Because, like, I look at Keith Olbermann's thing sometimes. I'm like, why are you fighting with these? Just fucking be a news. Just be a guy. Stop fighting with idiots. Who cares? Like, by ignoring it, you're just like, yeah, I got it. Yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah. I'm still working. My follower count's going up. I'm doing shows. By the way, I'll be in Chicago this weekend. Like, it's the most powerful thing you can do is not engage, because there's just nothing, there's rarely anything good that'll come out of it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the like saddest things I ever heard was Ryan Adams called a guy from a local rag.
Ben Folds told you that.
Was that what? Yes,
Ben
that's
Folds
right.
Told you that on this podcast, that's and then right. He played and then the and he played it, the message. Yeah,
and it's like that's right. That was so crazy.
Yeah, this guy that kept ragging on him. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this guy kept on. No, it was like, wasn't it just one? It was like one or two like articles this guy wrote, and he mentioned how like Ryan Adams is uninspired, blah blah blah. Which is like, you know, Harmar put it best when he said he's like the worst, like the most ironic thing a music reviewer could say about a musician is that they're uninspired.
right.
But it's this thing where he calls up the guy and he leaves a message saying like, it's like just complaining about what the guy's writing about him, and that's a lot of effort. A lot of effort on Ryan Adams' part, and it's I think that we were having a very, very similar conversation with Ben Folds about that. I think that's why he brought that up.
You know what it is though? It's that we as performers, well, most people, but we as performers, we have insecurities, and so when people say stuff, it scratches at those insecurities, and then you start to go, they're going to know. They're going to know that I suck. They're going to know that I'm a fraud. They're calling me out. They're seeing it.
They're seeing it,
I thought that I was hiding it so well, but they're seeing it. They're seeing it.
Yeah.
And so you get really defensive. What the fuck? What's your problem? Why would you say that? And you don't have to do that. You know, you don't have to, you know, if someone thinks that, they can think that, you know, they don't know you.
They don't know you. And you forget, like, when you're around your friends and everybody and every celebrity you've ever met who's so much cooler, different, or weirder, or has, like, the coolest guy you know, turns out he's, like I hung out with Dave Grohl one night, and one of his best friends is Jeff Probst. I mean, Jeff Probst is the host of Survivor. Like, they're just people. We're all just people. And so you do it based on what you are. It doesn't matter. They don't know you. They know nothing about you, and they have an idea of who you are. Somebody thinks Dave Grohl's the punkest of the punk, or he would never have a friend like that. And, you know, or Kurt Cobain was like, I like the Smithereens. Like, they forget to put that stuff in the, you know, they forget to realize that we like a lot of things, and we're all different, and no one's just one thing. And it just doesn't matter. But engaging just is you lose. The second you engage, you've played a pair of twos.
And also, you aren't going to win. I mean, every time I've done it, you know, a lot of times I've taken the approach of just trying to reason with people of like, hey, I'm just talking to you on a human level, like, you know, be nicer to people.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you know, that whole, if I could save just one, you know, there are more important dragons to slay in the world. And also I'm disappointed in myself because it's such a narcissistic endeavor. It's such a narcissistic endeavor to try to change one person's opinion about you.
Yeah.
Like what they have to say about you has any weight because you don't know anything about them. Mm-hmm. They don't know you. They're just judging you based on...
But remember this. They're thinking about you, and you don't even know them. You weren't never thinking about them. When he's just not that...
Because we're too busy thinking of ourselves.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But when, I'd rather do that. No, but you just... You don't even... Like, you do something that allows you to be looked at and seen. And that's good. You're being seen. Now, everyone that sees you is not going to like you. But who cares? Because you achieved the thing you wanted to, which is to be... seen or heard or listened to. So some people aren't going to like it. When He's Just Not That Into You came out, there were tons of a guy wrote a book about how he didn't like our book. A book about our book, liking our book. And someone said to me, does that make you mad? I go, he wrote a book about our book. No, I love it. Yes, people should hate it. It stands on point and it makes it has an opinion and it knows what it wants. And if you don't like it, good. Fine. Go get your help somewhere else. This is what I believe. And the people that like you go, I love this guy. He's not going to back down. He's not going to change his opinion for anybody. He's going to be my guy. That's the people you want in your audience, because they're the ones that need to believe in you and know you're not weak. They need to like go, no, good. He doesn't fuck. Yes, of course some people aren't going to like At Midnight or your record or my band. Like, they're, it's, you know.
Well, yeah, because ultimately.
Nobody doesn't like my band, though. It's the weird.
The Reigning Monarchs?
The Reigning Monarchs are unbelievably universally loved.
But ultimately, and also the thing to understand about a creative endeavor is that whether it's music or a piece of art or, although, you know, a painting can be a little more open to interpretation, but still, a piece of art or comedy, is that ultimately you're stating an opinion because you're trying to make a point about something, mm-hmm. because you're trying to get a reaction out of people.
100%.
And so when you take a stand on something, no matter what it is, there's someone in the world who was like, I feel the opposite of that.
It would be like if you were a boxer and the second somebody hit you, you were like, what was that all about? Jesus Christ.
What are we doing here?
What is that? He just hit me in the fucking face, dude.
In the end, what's going to happen?
And the guy's like, but we're boxing, yes? Yes. I don't know why he...
Vladimir Klitschko. Oh, that's why I'm paralyzed from the neck down. I just got punched by Vladimir Klitschko. Congratulations on the baby.
Yeah, like we're the lucky ones that we are
lucky.
Incredibly lucky.
But you know, I feel lucky. I mean, of all the stuff, and I'm not trying to make your podcast about me, and I apologize, but I'm just trying to relate things to you, and maybe you will agree or have stuff to add. But of all the things that I've achieved, a lot of that's just hard work and like not giving up and refusing to, you know, to go quietly.
Right.
But one of the things that I'm the most proud of is that I only work on stuff I like. And that's an insane gift to have. And that the people that come out to the shows, like the people who recognize me or the people who go to the shows, they're good people. And somehow I have attracted that. And that to me is probably one of the things that I'm the most proud of in terms of like success. Is not, you know, yes, I'm happy that I work on a bunch of shows and have, you know, like that's all great. But the thing that really, 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 really makes me feel like I think I did something right was that I look around and I'm proud of all the stuff that I do and I'm proud of the people who appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I that's the when we started walking the room, which is, I guess, I don't know, 200 episodes, so however, 4 years old or whatever. When we started that was the beginning of, okay, I'm going to do shit that I like. And I'm going to be me. And here's a place I can be me. And then I can take a job consulting on a TV show I don't care about.
But you never think that. You never think you has any value. So you go, well, why would anyone want to listen to me? I don't have any. I'm not. And you realize, like, oh, because you're a value.
Well, and also Dave made a really good point. He goes, it's not for everybody. It's just for the people that like you. They just want more of you, and you're not making a record anytime soon. You're not making a comedy album anytime soon, and they would want to hear you. They would want to know what you're up to. Yeah. And I was like, that's a really good point. Like, people are like, there's too many podcasts. No, there's not. The podcast is for your fans. That's who it's for. And sometimes you make other fans, and then sometimes your podcast becomes something that creates fans in and of itself. But at the very minimum, it's for Greg Barrett and Dave Anthony fans that want to know more about Greg Barrett and Dave Anthony.
So many people need a Dave Anthony in their life, just a guy to go, who gives a fuck? I don't give a shit.
It's true. Dave was a really good friend during that whole thing because he was the one that was like, dude, you're going crazy, you know? And he was constantly saying, you know, you should get some. I'm like, dude, I'm totally fine. You know, he didn't know, but, you know, having that weekly get together also jarred everything. Like, that was also another thing that made me go, man, I think I'm fucking up. because I can see it in Dave's eyes that things aren't going well. And also the podcast listeners were like, what the fuck was that podcast all about?
Oh, wow.
I made a lot of sounds. I made a lot of... The Griffin. I call myself the Griffin, and I really.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you did.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh shit, I didn't even really think about it.
Well, 'cause I used to tell people that I'd spit golden awesome, which I do. I do spit golden awesome, and I still call myself the King Sweater. So I mean, I have problems, and that's only because Patton called me Sweater Girl, which is Sylvia Plath's nickname, and then she put her head in an oven. But so yeah, he called me the Sweater Girl, and then the fans started calling me Sweater, and then I was like, well, I'm the fucking King Sweater then, and then. I've got my own kingdom. I have a lot of things still to work out, but I'm doing
it. You know, everything that you just described, I'm really sorry to say this, so I hope you don't take this wrong, but everything you just described, if someone said, if they said all those things and then the end quotation marks and it went, said Charlie Sheen, I'd be like, ah, okay.
Yeah, just right there.
Is that right? I spit gold, 100%. Griffin, I'm the sweater king.
I was vaguely, like, I thought Charlie Sheen was going insane, but I also kind of dug it.
Yeah,
like I kind of dug the whole tight, whatever his whole winning thing. Like there was something about that I was like, well, this is, it's insane, but it's a little bit funny.
Yeah,
it's a little bit fun, like, winning.
Yeah.
Like it was, it didn't seem too far afield of what a comic would do.
Yeah,
or Brody.
So in your mind, what is healthy to you? Because obviously, you know, if you're taking dog Vicodin and you feel okay when you do that, one part of your brain might go, yeah, but if I feel okay, what's the problem? And then you get out of that and you go, well, that's all artificial and that's going to get progressively worse until you die.
Yeah.
A horrible death from some type of internal failure.
Yes.
So how do you, you know, now how do you get through those dark moments and be what do you consider healthy, like emotionally healthy?
My emotionally healthy for me is not happiness. It's not being sad. It's 100% like I'm just not sad, and I just am not, like, I don't want to be, because happiness is a mania of its own, which I think a lot of people equate with a place that you kind of can't get to, because we have those big ups and those big downs, but those big ups are just as unhealthy as the big downs. Because they're not, they are generally also not real. They're, you know, fire, they're like dopamine and, you know, and adrenaline and all that stuff.
I've never heard anyone describe it that way before.
Yeah. So it's like, I like being right here. Like, I'm having a great time, but I'm not changing what this is to make myself even happier. You know, like when I was at your house the other night, I was hanging out with Jonah and I was like, this is just a good time. It's just right sized. It was like, it wasn't crazy. We had great conversation about music, but I was just like, I was really happy. I just was like, and happiness in that, like, this is just fine. You know what I mean? It's not.
Do you think that's the antidepressants talking?
No, I think there's some, no, I think there's a level of that. Absolutely. I mean, I had to figure out how to get there because my brain was only wanting either up or going down. And then I even liked the depression because then I was really like self-centered and focused in on my God. It's all hard. And nobody has it like me. It's all just self-centered. But now I just am. I can go on stage and I can have a crap set and go, cares, it'll be fine. And then I'll go on stage and have an epic set and go, I lucked out tonight. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't have a value. But when I'm watching my daughters dance, I cry. I feel something genuine because I allow myself to be, like, that's what matters. And when I, you know, or when I'm with my wife and I'm, you know, hanging out and just like, this is fine. This is just, it doesn't, you know. And also I think it's part of its age too.
Just to clarify, you don't make your daughters dance for you, right?
I do. I
okay.
do.
Okay. Because you didn't really, it sounded a little.
Yeah. I own some guns.
Yeah. And while they watch you cry, that's just the weirdest part of it.
Yeah. But like, they did a recital the other day on Father's Day. And like, Father's Day was, it was one of those things where Father's Day was not about me at all because there was a lot of shit going on with my daughters. And it would have bugged me a year ago. I would have been like, what the fuck? And I was like, I don't give a shit. This is great. This is all about my daughters. It's all about their day. It was all about my wife and shit that we had to get done. And I was like, this is epic. And then I can be like, that is a good thing, you know? And I feel that way about my career and everything else. I'm like, I'll just do what comes up next. It's not like I don't work on shit, but it just doesn't have the stakes. So I can't get that let down. I think people put big stakes on everything, you know, how their show's going to rate, what people are going to think about it, how, you know, how many tickets did you sell? Like that kind of stuff. And it just, nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. And how often do you know people that just, when they get those things, they're just like, okay, I'm in this perfect place and here I stay.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it is. It is, it is a, describing happiness as a mania is really funny to me.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to put it. I mean, like, I don't...
Because we look at it as a thing to shoot for as opposed to not being sad, which is easier to... You start thinking, well, how do I not be sad? How do I not get to that place? That's an easier thing to work on than what's going to make me happy. Who knows? Because it never, it's never what you expect. Happiness comes from, exactly like I'm saying, I go to your house the other night, I'm going to the podcast, I'm late, I'm like, oh, it'll be fun, we'll talk about music. I come out, I go, I just fucking had a great time. I didn't expect that to be like that. No expectations. I like Joan, I wanted to have a good time, but it was like just fucking fun. It was people having a good time, and I didn't expect it, so it was great. And that's why I'm with my stand-up. Like, when I go on stage, I'm like, this could be terrible. I'm not even, I don't bring a notebook anymore. I don't make notes. I just remember all of it, and I go up, and I do it, and, you know, but most of the time, it's great. Most of the time it's chill. It's great.
So what is the Atlantic Ocean Comedy Music Festival?
I'm doing the Jesse Thorne boat party thing.
I did that last year.
Yeah. Oh, that's Jesse's thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it
it's real crazy.
I think it has a better title than the Jesse Thorne boat people thing. It's called the Boat Party.
The Atlantic Ocean Comedy Festival.
Yeah. And there are a lot of good people on it, including Matt Bronger.
Now, if a bunch of you guys date, should I host a show about that on the cruise?
Boat date.
Yeah, boat date.
Oh my God, Joe Wagner, I would love to do a boat date. Remember that?
I remember Shipmates. Shipmates was my show that I kept turning down and then finally was like, oh, okay, I think I can make it my own. Like that was one of my experiences with that.
I remember seeing you, because it's funny, because I remember the beginning of the end for you of that stuff. I remember you were doing it, and I saw you at the Improv, and I was like, I remember thinking, your head is huge, like your actual face.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
you were very bloated, very like... Mm-hmm. Like I remember, and I was with Amira, and she goes, he was such a handsome boy.
Oh my God, I remember this when after I quit drinking, you told me something like that, and you said, and I think Amira said to me, you look so much better.
Yes.
You look so healthy now.
Yeah. Because she worked at MTV, so she knew who you were for a long time, and she's close with Jenny. She remembers you and liked you a lot and always thought you were handsome. And then we saw you one night at the Improv, and we were both like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know?
What happened? But of course, when you're that person, you're like, why is everyone so weird?
It was when you were in that.
Why is everyone so small faced?
It was when you were in that period of like, it was when that thing where you would just take cabs.
Yeah, because I was a responsible drinker.
Yeah, you were very responsible.
I mean, I was not responsible to my own body and organs, but I was responsible in terms of
But it's such
drive.
A nice story, man. It's such a good story. It's a great
story.
Well,
we both have. So you managed to get off the dog Vicodin.
Yep.
What was the first step that you took for that?
Well, I got thrown into a rehab. So that was the first step. And then I just needed to. Sometimes you just need someone to go, okay, we're going to fucking change this.
And it's incredible. And you're fucking in your.
And I was open. I wanted it, but I was so embarrassed because I'd had 15 years of sobriety that I couldn't admit it. That was the prison I put myself in. You're a sober guy. So, and I thought I was keeping it a secret, but eventually that secret gets out and then someone's like, you need to get your shit together and what's going on? And then I said, well, I've been taking all the dog pills. And they're like, you need help. And so then I was like, yes, I do. I give up really easily. I'm not a fighter. Yeah, because essentially somebody's going, well, we're going to give you a big hug. And I'm like, I'll take a big hug. And then I just went willingly and I got off them. You know, it's a pretty rough, you know, withdrawal. Because it's an opiate and it takes a long time. It takes like months for it to get out of your system. Oof. So you feel weird, you know. I mean, it's a week of sweating and throwing up and all that kind of stuff. But then you are where you are. But then I was like, wow. But then I was like, I felt like I'd identified that I had depression and anxiety. So I was like, okay, let's fix this. And then I've gone about fixing that. And now I feel like, okay. Now, because I think that was also part of the alcoholism. And I think it's something that a lot of people have that is, you know, they've got, you know, not voices like different voices, but like a voice that's like, God damn it, you're fat. Jesus. Like, go look at yourself in the mirror again. Make sure you're okay. Go look at yourself in the mirror again. And say, okay. Go see how you're doing on Twitter. Go Google. Like all of this like stuff that is, you know, ultimately tearing you apart. And these voices that are like, oh man, David, like I used to have David Cross's voice in my head. Like, that's not funny. He never said anything shitty about me ever.
Why do you think people do that?
I just think it was. I think it was partly just mental illness. Just me not having enough self-esteem and being able to figure out it, and that's how it manifests. It just manifests in you're not good enough, and that's why people drink. So I think it's sort of the chicken or the egg. Like, were you an alcoholic or were you mentally ill? And then that's how you decided to deal with it. I think it's a little bit of both, you know. And I think my mom probably had it, and she was an alcoholic, and I probably inherited it in some way. And then I went and saw a therapist, and you know, got on regular meds, and they changed things for me. And then you know, Bob's your uncle. Bob's not your uncle, but.
Biscuits,
you know,
in the UK.
You know that one?
Yeah.
Biscuits in the UK.
Yeah, Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
Like, no big deal.
No big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then I got, I just got back into.
Biscuits, you know, in the UK is the new Bob's your uncle.
I'm going to start saying it a lot.
Okay, good.
But anyway, so then I just got, like, what we talked about already. I just decided, like, you know, focus on your family and let everything else sort of, you know, just sort of changed my, what mattered to me. Because I almost lost everybody. I almost lost my whole family. Like, my wife was like, we're done. Like, it was all done. Everything was done. Dave was done with me. I'd pushed the band. The band was supposed to go into the studio, and we had to push the record back 2 weeks. I upset a lot of people. And there was a lot of people that were like, yeah, you're an adult. Like, I could get this. I get this if you were 25, but you're 50. So it was like I had to, like, kind of work my way back into everybody's good graces.
Well, I'm glad that you were able to do that. I'm so happy for you that you were able to do that.
Yeah.
Because that could have gone such as bad as it was. It could have gone so much worse.
Way worse.
And you able to pull out of it. And I think that's important for people to know that even in those moments where you were throwing up and sweating in rehab, and you must have been like, well, I'm going to feel like this forever.
Well, also the thing is, with sort of in a bigger context, what we're talking about, your friends aren't going to hold you to some idea you have about yourself. So my friends don't care that I was sober and not sober. They just want me to be well. And I was like, no, I got to keep this. People have to think this about me, so I can't let this down. And then the general public, if you're in the media, they don't give a fuck either, because they're looking at everything. They're not just looking at you. You know how we are. We're on the Huffington Post, and we're looking at a million things. They don't give a shit. But the people around you never give a fuck. They don't. They just want you to be well. So you're afraid of them disappointing them. But if someone came to me and said, I'm back on pills, I'd be like, well, how do we fix that?
Yeah.
I don't give a shit. Like, let's fix that. Let's make that better. You know what I mean? Like, let's, you know, and I think most people's friends, and not only that, most people are excited to help you because then they don't have to think about themselves. So most people are like, cool, where do you want to go? Let's go to a rehab, or let's do something about that, you know? And I think that's what people are most afraid of is that their inner circle will be disappointed in them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I'm very happy that you were finally on. And
I'm glad we could just bring it, just do a really funny podcast.
Yeah. No, you know, it did have moments, but I think it was really great. I think a lot of really great stuff, because everything that you're describing are things that, you know, I especially just feel like if people listen to the podcast, they probably, a lot of them feel degrees of those things. And so it's very important to be able to hear that and to see that you're okay and that you're happy.
Dave and I have found that podcast listeners in general are people that are, we've found this a lot. Like, they need the pod, they like the podcast because some of them are introverts and some of them are people that have fears. And so this is like, these are friendships. The relationship people have with Nerdist, the relationship they have with Marin or any of them, they're friends. You're friends because you share stuff with them, and they like to hear this. They like to hear that there's hope or that there's something you can do. I've had people hit me up on the thing and say, what medicines did you do or what'd you do? And I'm always like, just go see a therapist. The best thing you can do is go see a professional first if you can get to it. And don't be the, you know, just get there. Don't worry about paying for it later. That's another thing. People are like, I don't know if I can afford. Just go fucking go. They'll take care of you. Therapists are generally pretty nice. They'll usually say, just
if you can find money for drugs and alcohol, you can find money for therapy.
Yeah, that's actually true too.
You can always scrape up something. But so, what are the dates of the boat fest, Atlantic Ocean Comedy and Music Festival?
Let me look it up.
Do you have those, Katie?
Yeah.
Katie just had it.
September?
Up.
No, it's in late July.
Late July
25th. It's 25th through the
20th.
Yeah. Huh?
20th through the 25th.
To the 28th.
28th. I thought you were saying 25th to the 20th.
No. July 25th to July 28th.
I don't want to be on a boat that long.
Yeah, I did it last year. It's a really fun time. I met a lot of really cool people, and, you know, you get to go to the Caribbean. It's really, really, really rad.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
the Jesse Thorne people are really fucking cool, too.
Oh, Jesse's great.
Yeah, Jesse's a good man.
But it is also fun because you are on a ship full of other people that are just on a cruise to be on a cruise.
Ah.
Or as Dan Deacon described them, adult Bart Simpsons.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, cowabunga. And thank you so much for being here, Greg Behrendt.
Dude,
Walking
it's good
the
to
room
see you
podcast.
Again.
Greg Behrendt.
Reigning Monarchs.
Reigning Monarchs.
Yep.
Healthier Living. And don't forget to check out Biscuits in the UK by the Hug Pistols. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
I hereby declare this podcast to be over.
Sweet shit, guys.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.